Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, everybody. Good evening.
Dark and stormy evening.
Dark and stormy night, yes. We have a dark and stormy night here in Richmond. Have some more rain coming this way.
Yes. So, cheers to a dark and stormy storytelling night.
Yes.
Chris Head cocktail.
Yes. Cheers.
So for anybody who's wondering, I'm drinking Original Sin cider. It's a blackberry cider, so that's why it looks like blood in my cup.
And obviously I didn't make that.
It's very tasty.
But I did make this. It's an old-fashioned, a barbecue old-fashioned.
Yes, he smoked the glass.
Yeah, very fancy. Not really. No, it came in a cup.
But it's tasty.
It's very tasty. So I'll take it.
Yeah.
So, hey, everybody out there, Facebook and on the Vibe Radio Network, thank you for joining us tonight for Hospital.
Yes, and after this week, we're going to take a week off, and we're going to start the every other week schedule.
Yep.
Thank you for staying with us and joining with us tonight, and we're going to kind of hop around the U.S. with some of these haunted hospitals and finish up back here in good old Virginia. So.
Yes. And you'll notice if you are watching on Facebook that this is no longer our theme and the COVID-19 quarantine live stream.
We are working.
We're working again. We just had our first weekend of tours back, so very excited to be back out and walking around and sharing some haunted history with people here in Richmond.
Talk to people at a socially acceptable distance.
Yes, it's very important. The social distancing aspect is still key.
Yes, so we're out giving tours every Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday for ghost tours.
Yep.
Our history tours are Thursday evenings and Saturday mornings. So you can check out our schedule. Both of them are posted up to October. I haven't posted October yet.
Yeah, we haven't figured out October yet.
We're kind of waiting and seeing.
One thing at a time.
But please, come on out. Check out our stories. We will show you around some of the haunted hospitals that are actually located here in Chalk and Bottom and up in Churchill. We have a couple of those on our tours. We're not going to talk about them tonight because they're on our tours. So definitely come and check those out. And in the meantime, we're going to start where we're going.
What is it about hospitals anyways? I mean, there's just something about them. People don't like going to the hospital as it is. Yeah, usually you're winding up there for some bad reason, for some reason you don't want to happen in the first place.
Losing flesh.
Yes. And then on top of that, you got the whole, if you go ahead and you want to start talking about insane asylums, which we are going to be touching on some of those this evening.
That's a whole nother level.
Whole nother level. And then go ahead and you think about the ones that get abandoned.
Creepy. Whole nother level.
Yes. So you got all kinds of stuff going on. We're going to be touching on a little bit of stuff here and there all evening long. And it's just one of those very classic classic Hollywood horror film tropes, the haunted hospital, the horrific hospital.
The Arkham Asylum. We're going to talk about the hospital that inspired that.
Yes. But, yeah, I mean, you see it all over the place in popular culture. Yeah. There's all kinds of movies out there. Season 2 of American Horror Story took place in an insane asylum.
Which you watched, I didn't.
Yeah, and, of course, you got Arkham Asylum from the Batman. And so you got all kinds of stuff. And so there's plenty of these famous asylums, and they're some of the most favorite places for people to go ghost hunting today. And, because you got all kinds of reports of paranormal activity, which kind of makes sense in a location where there's so much energy like this. So, yes, we are starting at a particular location up in Michigan.
Yes, so we're going to talk about the Traverse City Hospital in Michigan. And this is known as the Northern Michigan Asylum. It was built in 1881, the same year as our corporate headquarters. And that was because there was a demand for a third psychiatric hospital in that area. And the other two that were in the area were also Kalamazoo and Pontiac. It was a lumber baron, Perry Hanna, who was the father of Traverse City. He used his political influence to secure the location to be in his hometown. Now, this was under the supervision of Gordon W. Lloyd, and the first building was known as Building Number 50. It was constructed in a Victorian Italianite style according to the Kirkbride plan. We're actually going to talk about a couple of different asylums that were to follow this plan. It opened up in 1885, and it had 43 residents at that point in time. Now, under the direction of Dr. James Decker Munson, the first superintendent from 1885 to 1924, the institution expanded. They had 12 housing cottages, two infirmaries that were built between 1887 and 1903 to meet the specific needs of both male and female patients. The institution became the city's largest employer, and it contributed to its growth. In the 1933, large college-like buildings were constructed near the present site of the Munson Hospital parking deck and the Grand Traverse Pavilion. Now, long before group therapy and drug therapy of the 1950s, Munson was a firm believer of beauty is therapy. So he wanted to have a beautiful, comfort, pleasurable place for his patients to be treated and treat them with kindness. That was the philosophy. So they were provided year-round flowers from their own greenhouses. They had a variety of trees that were planted on the grounds. The restraints, like straitjackets, were forbidden. So far, this doesn't sound like too bad of a place to be.
Yeah, it was kind of nice under the circumstances.
Yeah. Also part of this is he believed in work as therapy. So they weren't just lolling around in hallways and beds. He wanted them to be physically active as well. So they actually were provided with opportunities to farm, to do furniture construction, to do fruit canning and other trades that actually helped keep this institution self-sufficient as well. The farm grew, began in 1985, and they purchased some milk cows as well. And within the decade, it included pigs, chickens, milk, meat cows, and vegetable fields. From the 1910s to the 30s, the farm was a home to world champion milk cows, the Traverse Calanthea Walker. Her grave is actually at the end of a dirt trail between the farm and the asylum today. Now, while it was established for the care of mentally ill, it expanded during the outbreaks of tuberculosis, typhoid, diphtheria, influenza, and polio. And it also cared for the elderly and served as a rehab for drug addicts. It was also used as a place to train nurses in the field. After Munson's retirement, James Decker Munson Hospital was established in his honor and the grounds in 1926 and was operated by the state well after his death in the 1950s. It was then replaced by Munson Medical Center in the 1950s, and it was the largest hospital in northern Michigan and one of the largest in the state. Now, it is the last of the original Kirkbride buildings in Michigan, of the original four that were there, and it's listed on the National Register of Historic Places. That happened in 1978, and it was designated a Michigan State Historic Site in 1985. Now, there, with the changes of the law and mental health care, their philosophies that brought on basically the decline of the hospital, the farm was closed in the 1950s. Most of the buildings were demolished in the mid-70s. In actually 1963, the main 1885 center wing of Building 50 was destroyed because it was deemed a fire hazard. And a new modern building was put up in its place. The use of the hospital declined, and it was closed in 1989. They lost over 200 jobs, and the local economy was closed.
That's pretty.
Yeah.
That's better than nothing in its own right.
Yeah. So it's hard when you lose a big facility like that. All right, so we got a couple of different hauntings there. Ghost School actually does a blog about this area, and so we found some of her stories that she has posted out there about what people are seeing at the hospital. I'll let Chris take over.
Ooh, okay.
He gets to talk about this, too.
Yes. So, I mean, there's fewer places that seem riper for a haunting than an insane asylum. And, well, the Traverse City Hospital certainly had its share of ghosts. Its resident spirits aren't exactly what you might expect. Life at the State Hospital wasn't always, all that great, given the usual horror movie treatment of asylums. In fact, many of the stories about the State Hospital ghosts suggest they are not tortured souls at all, but rather that they're spirits of places to returning to a place where they actually felt valued. Since there were no straitjackets or electroshock sessions at the State Hospital, and the doctors believe that beauty and work were therapeutic, this seems to be why the spirits are drawn back here. State Hospital's radical step for treating them like people, And when people, this is a happy and safe place for their patients.
Yeah, versus the negativity that you often associate with a place like this.
But even as progressive as the state hospital was, it still couldn't keep up with changing times. So at the end of its run, the remaining patients were sent out to other facilities. Or they were released to, unfortunately, have to find their way on their own, which is really kind of the last.
That's not really good.
No, definitely not the best thing. So, anyways, the historic building was sat vacant for a long time, gathering all kinds of graffiti and legends of hauntings until the development company stepped in. And now it's they turned the facility into this mixed-use space filled with shops and restaurants and apartments. And when people started living at State Hospital, now known as the Village at Grand Traverse Commons,
so
they
you can rent an apartment.
Yeah, they also started living with the dead. Legend has it there's a host of shadowy children at the old hospital. These shadowy beings could be easily mistaken for local kids, except they appear and disappear despite locked doors and barred windows, and they're not alone. In one of the newly developed shopping areas, workers report seeing a woman in contemporary business attire who steps up to the front register only to disappear when they come around the counter to greet her. This particular apparition is an eerie reminder that the state hospital's history isn't quite as far removed as we might think.
Yeah, remember only 1989.
Yeah, I was alive. Yeah. I've been alive for a little while by then.
Mm-hmm. I was in double digits by then.
Yep. Yeah, so the most famous of the haunted places at the state hospital is the Hippie Tree.
I love the name.
Yep. Legend has it that the great tree was struck by lightning and fell, breaking into three pieces. It's still there today and serves as a canvas for local artists who have covered it with graffiti and artwork. One of the local stories says that two boys were found murdered at the tree, though there's no record of the crime. Kind of a very graphic and intense crime to find no record of it, but
yeah.
All the same, whether or not any deaths have occurred there, the legend holds that walking a certain pattern around the tree will open a gateway to hell. No one knows what that pattern might be, though, or if they do, they haven't been willing to share it.
Let's keep it that way.
Probably for the best. One of the first restaurants to open at the renovated hospital was Trattoria Stella. From the beginning, stories about spirit activity were talked about. When they first opened, they had a hard time keeping some of the staff around because they got too spooked to work there. Other experiences include strange vibes people get near the buildings, people report seeing lights in rooms with no power, strange shadows moved about the dark corridors, and some people have recorded very creepy electronic voice phenomena, or EVPs. Psychics claim they have communicated with patients who had died there or are bound to the place for some reason. Whatever the experiences were, they were numerous for the urban explorers of this once desolate collection of abandoned buildings prior to their repurposing and renovation that they had gone through to today.
I'm kind of curious to check this place out.
I have to go up to visit Michigan.
We are going to have to go up to visit Michigan. We haven't ever been there.
No. Okay. No. No, just flown through Detroit a couple times. That's it.
Yeah.
Okay. Blind
road trip.
Yeah.
Again, anybody know anybody who wants to sponsor us to go on a year-long road trip to go see places, and we'll do podcasts and Facebook live posts. Well, we're more than willing to go.
So, with that, we're actually going to bounce down a little bit to the south and a little bit to the west.
Yeah.
Southwest.
We're going to
the heartland.
We're going to go to Kansas.
We're going to go to the heartland. Yes, we are going to Kansas. So, Topeka, to be exact.
Yes.
And the Topeka State Hospital, very original name. So it was formerly,
another Kirkbride.
Formerly the Topeka Insane Asylum. And again, in Topeka, Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
Topeka. This was an institution for the mentally ill, which had originally opened in 1879. It was opened to help ease the issue of overcrowding at the nearby Oswegatchie State Hospital, one that they actually got an original name for. We'll just say that. Both buildings were designed by renowned architect John Haskell. The hospital was built using the Kirkbride plan, similar to the Trenton State Hospital, Metropolitan State Hospital, and the Danvers State Hospital, The Kirkbride plan was based on the theories of Philadelphia psychiatrist Thomas Story Kirkbride, who suggested that natural light and good air circulation could have a positive impact on the mentally ill.
Agreed.
Mm-hmm. Good theory. Yeah. So
think about how we're all feeling after being cooped up for so long.
Mm-hmm. So as with a great deal many of these facilities at the time, the Topeka State Hospital eventually gained a reputation for patient neglect and mistreatment, mainly attributed to the lack of proper funding. Fund the hospitals.
Like fund the schools.
We'll leave it at that. There's our political outburst for this evening. Anyways, many horror stories exist about the facility, including that of a journalist who visited and saw a patient who had been restrained so long that his skin had begun to grow around the restraint. There are reports of abuse, neglect, and even rape. Some patients were kept chained and naked. Stories of patients being left to spend their days confined to rocking chairs in the hallways were common. A 1913 sterilization law was introduced and aimed at habitual criminals, idiots, epileptics, imbeciles, and the insane. And as a result, 54 people were sterilized at Topeka State Hospital before 1921. This is the stuff that nightmares are made of.
And this is not the only hospital that did it. It happened here in Virginia, too.
But from there, the number only went up. Number skyrocketed all the way up until the 1950s, when the practice was finally stopped. In 1951, the hospital was further criticized when it was discovered that a 59-year-old Danish immigrant called John Crabb had been wrongly incarcerated despite not being mentally ill. And, well, I'm sure...
Once you're in, it's not easy to get out.
Yeah. They're not going to let you out for just saying that you're not insane. It doesn't work that way. But in 1948, after a number of complaints, a panel was put in place to make changes to the facility, and improvements were made. By the 1960s, it was of the top hospitals of its kind in the USA. Pretty impressive turnaround going from hell on earth to one of the best hospitals in the country in about 10 years.
Oh, it can happen.
It can happen. Now, in 1992, the hospital was in the news when music and activity therapist Stephanie Ulrich was murdered by patient Kenneth Watrick, who was classed as a high-risk patron. Stephanie and another therapist took some of the patients out to watch a movie, and once back in the hospital, Wadrill killed Stephanie. Her body was found in a bathroom. The state mental health administrators were cleared of reckless conduct by the United States Court of Appeals in 1995, and Kenneth Wadrill was charged with the murder of Stephanie. These incidents alone would be enough to spark stories of paranormal activity on the property, but the existence of a 2.8-acre unmarked cemetery on the grounds has certainly added to the mystique. Gotta love the unmarked cemeteries. No, not so much.
We've talked about that. That's a no-no.
Yeah. The cemetery is the final resting place of patients who died at Topeka State and who were never claimed. They never got sent home to their families, if they had families at all. Only 16 of the 1,157 graves here have headstones. A memorial now stands in honor of those who died there. The state of Kansas ultimately closed Topeka State on May 17, 1997. The main building, as well as others, were ultimately demolished in 2010, but those who have spent time on the grounds believe it is still a hotbed of paranormal activity.
Yeah, so I will say, history, we got a ton of information on. It was really, really hard to find ghost stories on this that were not more than the something moved. So what they get most often are mist-like apparitions that do get photographed, and I was able to see some of those. Unfortunately, I didn't share them to my documents, so I can't show them to you on here. But they also get the sound of crying and sobbing that's been captured on EVPs and digital audio recordings. Music is often heard in real time emanating from the area from where the main hospital once stood. So those are the three things that constantly repeat over and over again in any stories that I found of the hospital. Definitely an interesting place I would like to go and see. I'm playing with the keyboard. Oh. There we go. Keyboard's gone.
Real quick question. Is there historical context for children being insane asylums?
Sometimes kids were put in there when they were not wanted. When we go back to legitimacy, when their mother and father were married, sometimes that was a way to hide away an unwanted child.
Mm-hmm.
Very sad way to do it, but it was, again, a way to do it. I don't really know. It was a place for criminals, for children criminals, to be locked away in, too, instead of the workhouse, so that they wouldn't be coming out as an adult criminal. But those are the only things I can think of.
Yeah. Weren't there cases where sometimes they were sent there with their parents when there was no other place for them to go?
Or they were born there because somebody was an unwed mother and was sent there as well.
Mm-hmm. So, I do recall there's definitely precedent for there being children at some of these institutions, which obviously not the best place for them, but it did happen.
All right, so we're going to jump over to Danvers. This is, again, a third Kirkbride institution, one that is still standing today. This is on Hawthorne Hill in Danvers, Massachusetts. And it has, of course, the Kirkbride building with the gorgeous Gothic-style spires and the red brick construction. The judge that presided over the Salem witch trials, John Hawthorne, once actually lived on this hill a few hundred years ago, and perhaps that dark history has cursed the building that currently sits on the hill, because he was definitely cursed by several people during that session. The facility that once housed Danvers State Hospital is now home to a residential community featuring a fully renovated apartment. However, the building.
What was that?
I have no idea. Something dark just fell behind our light. Chris is going to investigate.
Okay, we're good.
Okay, good. Ah, yes.
Okay.
Something I moved around when I was setting up my new desk today.
Debunked, not paranormal activity. Sorry, people.
Just dark fabric that fell, and I didn't stick it back into where it needs to go. Anyway, it was originally called the State Lunatic Asylum at Danvers. Construction on the hospital started in 1871, and the first few patients moved in sometime around 1878. At its peak, the facility had 40 buildings and maxed out at 450 patients. The goal of the facility, again, was to completely cure the patients of their ills. Danvers was a success, but by 1900, Danvers Hospital had employed 125 people and had treated more than 9,500 patients since its opening. Its good reputation proved to be Danvers' undoing, because over the next 20 years, more and more and more people started coming in. The population of the hospital swelled to more than 2,000 patients, despite this official capacity of 450. Administrators begged the state for money to build more rooms and hire on more staff, and they were denied. The horrific abuses then started. Patients walked through the hallways, again, also naked. They didn't have the funding to clothe everybody. They lived in their own filth, and the lack of basic hygiene. People were not being cured. The symptoms just got worse. Then came the straitjackets and the shock therapy. This became the norm in treating mentally ill patients, thinking that the jolts of electricity could either alter patient's brain waves or make the patient afraid of shock therapy and scare them into submission. When they misbehaved, they were put in straitjackets and forgotten. When the shock therapy failed, the lobotomies started. In 1939, the community was looking for a permanent fix to the crisis facing the mental health facilities. The population of the hospital swelled to 2,360 people, and a total of 278 people died at the hospital that year alone. Medical science saw lobotomies as a cure for anybody's insanity and as a way to stop the death. I don't exactly agree with that. Neurology experts often called Danvers State Hospital the birthplace of the frontal lobe lobotomy. The moniker came from its widespread use, but also from the procedure's refinement at the hospital. Visitors to Danvers State Hospital in the early 1940s reported the lobotomy patients wandering aimlessly through the halls of the hospital. At least the patients didn't complain, because many of them just stared blankly at the walls. Patients walked around in a drugged, hellish fate. No one would let them leave and help them against their will. That is, if the patients could actually express their thoughts after having part of their brain ripped out during the surgery. Now you can see why this place actually inspired Arkham Asylum.
That's something I drink.
Thank you. I need something to sip after this.
So, mind-bogglingly so, as before, and a reoccurring theme, the lack of funding continued. Buildings fell into disrepair, which made conditions all that much worse, and finally the state intervened. Portions of Danvers State Hospital were shut down in 1969, most of it closed in 1985, before a permanent shutdown in 1992, after which the site became a popular destination for thrill-seeking kids looking for a good scare.
Because that's what we do on Friday nights when we're younger.
Yeah. In 2005, a development company, we like these old places.
Oh, they like the Gothic building.
Yeah.
They're pretty. They're scary.
They bought the rundown but except they tear it down. They bought the property. They tore down a large portion of the building. The renovations turned the once macabre lunatic asylum into Avalon Danvers Apartments. Avalon. That is
the complete opposite of what that place represented.
Yeah. Construction faced delays in 2007 when a mysterious fire broke out and burned a majority of the new construction and some trailers. Perhaps the torment spirits of the dead put a curse on the place.
Or, as we said, the judge, the witches did it.
Yeah.
Or the non-witches, take your pick.
The Hell House on the Hill, one of several unkind yet accurate nicknames for Danvers State Hospital, looks brand new today. However, its reputation remains. Horror novelist H.P. Lovecraft used Danvers as the inspiration for his Arkham Sanitarium. If the name Arkham sounds familiar, well, that would be because you have Arkham Asylum as the backdrop for many of Batman's ultra-psychotic villains and where they wind up imprisoned when they're and then repeatedly breaking out so they can get imprisoned again. And
most recently featured in The Joker.
Yes. Arkham Asylum in Batman definitely has some security issues.
Yes, it does.
Anyways, whole sidetrack.
Back to the story.
The only remnants of the horrific practices that went on in Danvers State Hospital are the gravestones in two nearby cemeteries, which contain about 770 bodies. Some headstones only have numbers as opposed to names. Even in death, administrators at Danvers State Hospital did not dignify their patients.
And sometimes the family wanted it that way because they didn't want to be linked to it, but it's still a pretty sad practice.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, it's that practice.
Yeah, rather...
Shameful.
Shameful, yeah.
Let's just go straight to it. It's shameful.
Yeah. So, spookiness, yeah. Since 1992, the overwhelming energy of the property has attracted the attention from those who believe it is haunted by the souls who once lived and suffered within its walls. Apparitions of past residents, unexplained footsteps, and disembodied screaming, and the sudden and violent movement of objects within the building are not uncommon. Danvers was the filming location for the eerie 1999 horror film Session 9.
I will say I have walked by this property because I used to live in Boston, so I would, excursion out on the weekends. I got probably within two blocks of this property and went, nope, because you could feel the energy that far away.
Yeah.
No.
So, of course, it has drawn its fair share of paranormal investigators.
Yes.
Danvers has never been a ghost hunting hotbed because the site was closed to the public, but many paranormal investigators have tried to sneak into the compound. Many of them get arrested before they get all the way in.
They have a large security force there.
Yeah, can't imagine why. The state of Massachusetts and the community police routinely patrol the grounds. Over 120 ghost hunters have tried and failed to get access to the site.
Now, there have some who have actually succeeded.
Yes. There's a handful.
There are a couple that were sneaky. They had their ninja skills on, and they got in.
Yeah. For example, the Rhode Island Paranormal Research Group investigated at night at one time back in 1997. They haven't released any of the evidence from that night, nor have they even spoken about it, which is really unusual for a paranormal investigation group to go through all that trouble and then bit the lip. Today, it's tougher for a ghost hunter to get in. In 2006, Danvers was sold to a real estate developer, as we mentioned, and many of the buildings demolished, except the iconic steeple-topped administration building and its adjacent wings. Now you can rent a luxury apartment in them. And, yeah.
Patrick, you were asking about, can you get an apartment there?
Yeah. That particular part of the development is called Halstead Danvers. Stewart was a trained parapsychologist and licensed as a ghost hunter by the International Ghost Hunter Society. And he has been able to tour the ground, or excuse me, she has been able to tour the grounds, and she operates a museum of the supernatural up in Salem, from which she also leads tours of haunted areas. Her profession and passion being what it is, Stewart was drawn to Danvers State. In early October of one year, Stewart attended one of the regular site visits of the state allowed, and Stewart said that she managed to photograph a spirit orb by standing by a stand of trees using high-speed film during her visit. There's more in confirmed hauntings there at the hospital. Only one apparition has actually been firmly documented there. And Geraldine Levasseur family would hear footsteps in the second-story hallway of their home when nobody was upstairs. Doors would open and close. Lights would flicker on and off. Levasseur grew up on the grounds of Danvers State Hospital in a house lent to her father, hospital administrator Gerald Richards. She's now 52 and clearly remembers one day in her youth when her sister and a brother were playing upstairs in the attic and saw an apparition of an older woman angrily scowling at them. They were too scared to move until their mother ordered them to come down. She was in high school when her bed covers were pulled completely off of her bed. Nobody else was in her room. She was absolutely petrified, but she always had the feeling no real harm would ultimately come to her. She said that actually she generally had a good experience there. She admitted that there were some unsavory practices that took place, just a few, and most often the result of misguided efforts to treat patients, such as the electroshock therapy and hydrotherapy. Hydrotherapy, which is nowhere near as nice as it actually sounds.
Yeah.
So, if you think back to the beginning of medical science and the things that were done to people, now this quote, not because they thought they were what they were doing was bad, but because they were trying to do right, you have to wonder, did people think that they were being tortured? She believes that it is the tortured spirits that knew Danvers State as their home that linger around on the grounds today. Very creepy place. Yeah. That's kind of repetitive.
I forgot to delete that part.
We left something in.
Have a drink. You're going to need it. All right, so we're going to jump down to Waverly Sanatorium in Louisville, Kentucky. And this is one that a lot of people have gone to or have known about, and they want to go and investigate it. Waverly Hill Sanatorium was opened in 1910, and it was for tuberculosis patients. In 1911, the New City Hospital relocated all of the TB cases to Waverly Hill, which had erected tents on the grounds to accommodate the overflow that all of a sudden inundated them. The buildings were added to the institution in 1912, 1916, and 1926. A dedicated staff worked with thousands of TB patients, often contracting the disease themselves. After World War II, the need for a TB sanatorium waned until the hospital closed in 1961. Estimates vary, and records have been destroyed, but there have been as many as 64,000 deaths at Waverly Sanatorium. Also known as consumption, much easier to say, or was known as the White Plague, has a high mortality rate before streptomycin was introduced as the treatment in 1943. The most common treatment at the time was actually sunlight, fresh air, and a nutritious diet. Surgical intervention included removal of ribs and or parts of the lungs, and it was reserved for patients who were very close to death. However, many people owed their lives to the care that they received at Waverly. The institution was reopened as Woodhaven Medical Services as a geriatric hospital in 1962. It closed in 1980 under the allegations of patient abuse. Common theme here. Robert Aberhasky bought the property in 1996 with plans to erect the world's tallest statue of Jesus as a religious center. The statue would have been based on the Christ the Redeemer statue that is found in Rio de Janeiro. Only 20 feet taller than that statue because you got to go bigger, right? Well, the plans fell through due to funding problems, and Abernathy was upset that the remaining building was protected by the historical register. He tried to have the building condemned, and he went as far as using a bulldozer to undermine the foundation, but the building refused to collapse. Then Tina and Charlie Mattingly bought up the property in 2001 with the aim of completely restoring it. The hospital was deteriorating badly when they took possession. In the first few years of possession, the Mattinglys removed the asbestos and replaced 100 broken windows. Haunted tours helped raise money for the restoration project, which will eventually include a bed and breakfast there. So when that opens, Chris and I will go. If we love bed and breakfast. Now, I've been in a former TV hospital. When I grew up in Vermont, the police academy actually was located in one, and one of my summer leadership camps was there, and haunted as well by a nurse who had contracted TB. And there was a local fire department that owned another TB hospital that was actually for the third level of TB when you were on death's door. And they have a haunted house in there every single year as their fundraiser, which is really awesome, by the way. That place is haunted as get out as well, and it's not just the fake haunts that you have for a haunted house. So being in a tuberculosis hospital, I know what that feels like, even though I haven't been to this one. The hauntings, what they have here is unique because they have an underground tunnel, which happens in a lot of hospitals. There's a way to bring people in and out without being seen. Patients being brought in by families who were well-to-do that didn't want to be seen, that sort of thing. There's also a way to bring the bodies out so it would not upset the other patients that were there. And so this ran from the sanatorium to the bottom of the hill that it's on. It was originally a heating duct. And the tunnel then became a place for the staff to actually enter into when the weather became bad. It was nicknamed the Body Chute and was serviced by a winch that would then haul the supplies up and down the hill and lower the gurneys with the bodies down to the bottom. The tunnel was supposed to be haunted by those who made their last journey through it. You can still hear the gurneys going through with their squeaky wheels. I always find that very, very unnerving sound because they returned to Oz, got that sound perfect when they portrayed that mental asylum in there. The tunnel was the subject of a 2005 movie, The Death Tunnel. In the film, five college girls fulfill an initiation rite by spending the night in the haunted institution. You can imagine what follows.
No, I have no idea. Please enlighten me.
We can imagine. My horror movie fan here.
Yeah, I'm the one that watches the horror movies.
Yeah.
Not really her thing.
Now, they also did a documentary while they were filming The Death Tunnel, and that documentary was named Spooked. So I'd be actually curious to check that out. I like documentaries. There have been reported ghost sightings in room 502 at the sanatorium, particularly the ghost of a nurse in a uniform. There are two legends concerning the room. The nurse committed suicide by jumping out of the window, and a nurse who hanged herself in the room because she was single and pregnant. Neither story is actually documented, and neither is completely discounted. Other accounts tell of ghostly apparitions by a little girl named Mary and a little boy named Bobby in other areas of the hospital. It has become known outside of the area when the TV series The Scariest Places on Earth profiled the institution in 2001. Since then, it has become a very popular destination for paranormal investigators. Even those who don't believe in ghosts enjoy the site for its history, its controversy, and its popularity. According to the Waverly Hills Historical Society, the guided tours and overnight stays are booked up almost a year in advance. So it is very, very popular. You have to plan your visit and get your tickets. Of course, Ghost Hunters did a TV show here in March of 2006, and the sci-fi series returned and did a live broadcast on Halloween night. So, have we had questions?
There was one question that actually went back to the Danvers. Was there any evidence of when they were filming the Session 9 movie there, of there being paranormal stuff on the movie set?
Not that I found, but I didn't dig for it.
At the same time, I actually haven't found hardly any ghost stories of ghost stories on active movie sets.
Mm-hmm.
I almost wonder if it's too busy, too active.
Maybe. Too much electrical equipment.
Too much going on for, you know, maybe the spirits are there, but they just have a hard time putting themselves at the forefront, so to speak.
It'd be interesting to talk to some of the TV crews and movie crews that have worked, like, on Lincoln and some of the other historical buildings around here to see if they've had any experiences while they've been filming. Because we know our Capitol grounds are haunted, and they use that as one of their sets. So.
Oh, let's see. Love the TV series, Scariest Places on Earth. That was a good one.
It was a very good one.
Yeah, so many of those fun, those great... I still watched ones for like 10 years ago.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
They were great. They're fantastic.
Yep. Yeah. So I there's some of them I have no idea how many times I've seen.
Yeah, I think I'm watching a series of one in Britain right now that's like 15 years old. You can tell by the hairstyles.
Let's see. Elle says that she just learned about body shoots earlier today.
Mm-hmm.
Rather unnerving coincidence.
Yes.
And Kiana says, what the heck? Something keeps creaking outside.
Oh, boy. Outside your place or outside our place? Because we got thunder going on.
Yeah, it's rumbly out here. I'm assuming outside her place.
Okay.
And Patrick says it's probably just a chupacabra. Don't worry about it.
We just had somebody post on a paranormal page. I'm pretty sure it's a wolf or something with mange. But everyone's like, chupacabra.
Very supportive of Patrick.
Yeah.
Chupacabra. Chupacabra.
All right.
It's just fun to say.
It is.
Chupacabra.
It's like the Snally Gaston. It's fun to say. Which does come to Virginia and Richmond particularly.
So we're here?
Yes, we're jumped down to Greenville, South Carolina.
And
we're getting closer to Virginia.
Now, this is a terrible name for a hospital. Terrible name. They call it the Devil's Castle.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. When I was researching this, I was finding conflicting reports that the Devil's Castle and the hospital are possibly two separate buildings, but somehow the Devil's Castle has morphed itself onto the hospital as a nickname. It was very weird.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind. Some people, it's not that that's something else, but it somehow attached itself to this hospital.
An old tuberculosis hospital, no less.
Yep, we went from insane asylum to TB.
Yep.
Good time.
So, anyway, this place is located on Beverly Road, which is it's just not too far from the farmer's market down there in Greenville, South Carolina. Now, no trace of the building remains today, although you can still visit the spot where it once stood. This location was known as the Hopewell Tuberculosis Sanatorium, and it served as Greenville's tuberculosis sanatorium from the 1930s up until about 1950. Relatively short life for a hospital compared to some of the other ones we've talked about. After that, it was used to house the criminally insane, and then it was used as a prison work release site. Locals call it the asylum, the old tuberculosis hospital, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Apparently, nobody wants to call it the criminally insane asylum.
No.
Yeah. Anyway, with its gothic features and shuttered windows, it became known by the early moniker, the Devil's Castle, in the local nomenclature before it burned to the ground in 2002. Herdklotz Park sits on the site today. Now, according to the South Carolina Paranormal Research Investigations Group, apparently they put together this acronym, Anyways, but they had blood-curdling screams came from the first floor of the building. Witnesses reported hearing footfalls that suddenly broke into a run. Nothing unsettling about that. People reported being pushed while investigating on the third floor, and those pushed also heard loud clattering coming from the halls. Objects moved around on their own, and it was a rumbly, stormy night around us here. Apparitions appeared before witnesses, and disembodied singing voices had been heard.
Now, see, that creeps me out. I don't know why, but disembodied singing voices creep me out. Yeah, that's part of it.
At least two different law enforcement officers separately told a bone-chilling tale about the building before it burned. Both said that they and other deputies would clear the building of any wayward teens and homeless people who might be in there, but as soon as they would be about to leave, they would hear voices echoing whispers down the dusty halls. They, of course, would double-check the building, but never find anything living, that is. It was said that on the first floor, you could hear footsteps break into the run and screaming, and, that's repetitive again. Oops.
I did not do a good job editing.
Neither did I. That's kind of my job. Sorry. But anyway, so later on, even though the building is gone, as I said, you can go visit the site today, and the site was visited, the Herdplatz Park, by psychic Jason Prophet. Now, Jason visited the park with his best friend's wife during the day, and while they were walking around, he quietly asked if anyone was still there. If so, he would come back and do some more research. This was his common practice at haunted locations.
Here, a quick question. Glenn asked what caused it to burn, and actually, I could not find that.
Good question. I mean, for abandoned buildings, oftentimes it comes back to people people living there, setting a fire to keep themselves warm, and their little makeshift fire gets out of control. That's oftentimes what happens in abandoned buildings.
And that would be my guess, is it was probably a misplaced, a fire that got out of control that was there due to somebody being in the building that shouldn't have been in the building. I didn't hear anything about purposely it being set as arson, and I didn't see anything about it being a freak accident of lightning. So,
good question, though.
Yes.
So, but anyways, after Jason his companion there, his best friend's wife, they walked around for about 10 minutes. They got back into her car, and her headlights were on, whereas they had not been on when they left the car. This was the signal that there was still some activity at the site. Jason then went for his Reiki session, and his Reiki practitioner was led by her guide to take him back in time to when she used to sneak into the old sanatorium.
So for those of you not familiar with Reiki, you have a spiritual guide who helps you move through the session to help either yourself or the person you're treating. That's what they're referring to. And he prompted her to take him back, tell her experiences, not actually physically taken back in time. We're not time traveling, as much as I wish my Reiki guide would do that. He's not that good. But that's what they're referring to.
Yeah. So she asked, you know, it's now a children's park, right? And here is where it gets really weird. They left the original boiler room intact and possibly the entire basement, both of which were known to be very active areas. Now they're just sealed up. She continued, when it burned to the ground, they just flattened the old building and built the new playground equipment right on top. The playground is in the physical space that used to be inside the building footprint. Jason and his practitioner went to the park, and he recorded their conversation and was quite startled to hear some impressive EVP clips of the background chatter and banging in the clips. It was broad daylight, and they got very clear lunchroom-type clatter and screams, none of which was happening in person. The sound is not something you have to strain to hear. Anyone listening could swear that there was all sorts of ruckus around them, so loud at times that they would have to speak louder if it was really there in the present. They left the original main entry steps intact, and those now lead to the playground. As we stood there, we discussed the layout of the original building, and on the recording you hear a very clear bell-type sound with an echo in a hall. This sound was not in the physical world while we talked. We were standing in what would have been the old lobby. The recordings outside of the building site sounded less like a cafeteria and were slightly different in nature, but still with banging. While the recordings today are more lighthearted in nature as far as the nature of the EVPs, Jason is certain the tone and feel of the recordings will be more sinister once the sun goes down. Just a few months back, a guy and his friend saw a pool of blood near the horseshoe area. They got freaked out and left the park, but a bit later they went back due to curiosity, and it was gone.
Yeah, I'd be out of there, too. Now, we have another fun comment here. Tracy says, the broiler room reminds me of Freddy Krueger.
Yes.
You're familiar with that.
Yes. So Wes Craven actually was a professor at my university for a couple of years. He was a professor at Clarkson University in Potsdam, New York for a couple of years. This was well before I was ever a student there. And It is said that the boiler room, that classic boiler room scene, is actually based off of the boiler room in Old Snell Hall in downtown Potsdam. It's a building part of the Clarkson University campus. So you go down to the boiler room there, and it's supposed to be the inspiration for the Freddy Krueger infamous boiler room scene.
Now, I honestly want to break into Old Snell anytime we're up there because I want to go see this. I've been in Old Snell. I've been in there for theater production.
But the old boiler room is definitely
off-limits. Yeah, we're going to come back and talk about our colleges probably in the fall because both of our campuses are very haunted and have some very interesting connections, both to Hollywood. Both of them do, which is kind of unique because, I went to the liberal
school.
You
more so.
But he's got Wes Craven.
I got Wes Craven.
I got Viggo Mortensen. I got Kirk Douglas.
Yes, you do.
I got Irene Bergman.
You won an award named after Kirk Douglas.
I did. Anyway, moving on.
Anyway, yes.
So we're going to jump to North Carolina now.
Yep,
we're getting closer.
We're getting,
closer.
Okay.
What did you do?
I don't know. Okay, there we go. Hi. Hi, script.
Don't lose the document because I didn't write them anywhere else.
Yeah, and we don't need to lose the scripts 2 weeks in a row. That's another story. We won't. Yeah, we won't go there. So, the haunted Broughton State Hospital in Morganton, North Carolina. So, this was built in 1883, and Broughton State Hospital was originally named Western Carolina Insane Asylum. At one point in the 1920s,
at one point in the 1920s, the understaffed hospital was overwhelmed with patients. And again, common thing. There was only one doctor for every 355 patients. That's not good. The spawned patient neglect and abuse. Patients died under circumstances, and soon stories about the hospital being haunted began to surface. According to WSOC-TV, experiments that went wrong and patient suicides were also part of the dark past of this hospital. The Broughton State Hospital in Morganton, North Carolina, is, of course, said to be haunted. After all, however, there's never actually been a paranormal investigation conducted since it's actually still operating as a psychiatric hospital to this day, so they won't let you in to do an investigation. Ghosts have been seen on a regular basis by hospital staff and patients. The BH, or the Broughton Hospital, is considered to be one of the most haunted places in the state, although it does not officially or otherwise acknowledge the existence of ghosts there. Similar situation with some of the places that we have here. They don't want to acknowledge that they exist, but if you talk to the right person, you get the story. So the hauntings that happen here, according to eyewitnesses, paranormal activity is common, especially during the graveyard shift or the third shift of the day. Just ask Margaret Langley, who was a registered nurse, about her job. She quickly will tell you about the ghost in the hospital that she has worked for over two decades. Her ghostly encounters prompted her to write the book Haunted Brighton, Tales from the Graveyard Shift, and it includes real-life ghost stories others tell about the hospital. She felt that these events needed to be documented. So things that have been witnessed by the workers and the patients, this includes the sounds of slamming doors, cold spots, apparitions in the darkened hallways and corridors, disembodied voices calling patients by their names, chilling screams heard from abandoned areas of the hospital, mists and blue orbs traveling along the hallways. The areas that have the most paranormal activity were employees who are working the late night shift witness the strange anomalies. These are usually in areas that are no longer used, such as the high control areas for violent, uncontrollable patients and the wards where the criminally insane were once housed. These places are known for intense paranormal activity, states Margaret. She says the BH is totally different place at night. You see the shadows out of the corner of your eye and you hear things that cannot be explained in these areas. Witnesses have also reported seeing a vaporous cloud floating down the hallway about 5 feet high off the ground. They will stay in there in amazement and watch the cloud sort of melt away. She says two co-workers quickly investigated and only could come to one conclusion, that it was a ghost or a spirit. Of course, if you see a vaporous cloud, the first thing you're checking is there chemical? Do they have a leak? That sort of thing. Is it dangerous? But again, they can only assume that it is ghostly activity. The stations are known to haunt their underground tunnels. Most hospitals have some type of underground network for various reasons. We have them here in Virginia, too. Capitol Hill is a network of tunnels that connects actually to VCU Hospital. So we have plenty of them ourselves. I would love to get into them. Just a note, if anybody's got connections, I want to go play. The network of tunnels runs underneath the hospital connecting the series of the buildings. They used to transport patients, to different buildings. And it's rumored that wealthy families used the tunnels to admit family members and later to visit undetected by the public. The steward and the matron of the asylum would check on the wards and the patients by carrying a lantern and walking through the tunnels. And there are also tracks in the tunnels leading from the kitchen to the laundry room in order to transport supplies back and forth through the hospital. And these are tracks that are seen in dust that's not always swept away right away.
Mm-hmm.
There were, of course, stories of brutality here in the hospital, severe brutality with patients being chained to the walls and the underground tunnels. However, Margaret believes this is just one of those stories that was told to embellish the ghost factory. She goes on to explain in her book, I've talked to people who have actually been down there. They report no signs of change existing today. However, employees have reported hearing the sounds of rattling of chains and moanings and wailings down in that area. If this was a place for criminally insane, you might be hearing the chains on former prisoners as they're being walked up to that section of the hospital. So that could be the chain activity that they are hearing. Ward 8 has a ghost as well. The nurse working on the night shift in Ward 8 will often finish up with paperwork, start down the hall to join another staff member who's sitting in the seating area. She begins talking to her coworker, and she notices a shadow appear to be sitting on the sofa at the end of the hall. Her coworker noticed her attention drawn to this area, and he explained that the ghost was a man playing solitaire. When she turned to look directly at the shadow man again, she was able to tell his movements were those of somebody playing cards. So the, that movement.
A little bit of solitaire action.
Eventually, the shadow vanished into the air. The coworker explained how he saw the same ghost regularly during the twilight hours and had become used to it. So our disembodied voices, people have reported hearing their names called by disembodied voices. Margaret specifically heard her name called by a female voice, a loud whisper, one night while she was working alone in the Bates building. She also experienced a strange sensation. She had never had a fear of being there prior to that night, and it scared her so bad that she felt like an iron prod was being shoved up her spine into the base of her skull.
Ouch.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
Enough of that. New.
Okay, I'm going to have a drink now.
Yes. And we're going to get to one of our main events for this evening.
Yes.
So, if you saw the cover photo for our little Facebook Live tonight, you might have recognized it as the famous, or is it infamous?
Infamous.
St. Albans. And we actually had one of our friends just tune in here. We got Steve Dills, who is the founder of Transcend Paranormal. He's on our live stream chatting in here in the chat with some people. He provided some of the information that we're going to be sharing for the story. So,
and we actually have another friend on, Whitney, that here.
Yes. Yep, Whitney
She
well.
Provided another one, so I'm getting that off my phone right now.
Yes, yes.
I'm not being rude.
No.
I didn't have time to put it in that document.
Yes. So, anyways, St. Albans. It's out in Radford, Virginia, if you are not familiar with it. And also, to be very clear, right up front, the place is private property, and do not visit it without express permission from the landowner, just to be very clear.
Yeah. Now, they do have several investigations there during the year. In fact, our friends with Twisted Paranormal is actually hosting one with Haunted Night. So they have that on their calendar. I'm sure those tickets are going very quickly, so definitely if you want to go and visit with them, then go book your ticket now for that.
The origins, the history of the land that St. Albans was built on begins all the way back in 1775. We're talking, you know, the late colonial, just pre-revolutionary days, with the Draper Meadow Massacre. This murder of five people, including an infant child, set the tone for the darkness that has become the legacy of this imposing complex.
I'm going to jump in there because Whitney is also a researcher with the Valentine Museum, and she was able to find out... Here it is. The massacre actually didn't take place on the ridge. It took place in Blacksburg, Virginia, on the Virginia Tech campus.
Oh.
So that's something I literally just learned an hour ago.
And that's why it hasn't been corrected.
It's been a year. Yeah.
Good to know. All right.
But it was about boys' school, which is our next bit of history.
All right. So the St. Albans Lutheran Boys' School was built in 1892 and quickly developed a reputation for being a rough and competitive school where bullying was not only condoned, it was actually encouraged. Many young men were lost during the years the school was active, with quite a few of those deaths ruled to be suicide.
Bullying got out of hand.
Yeah, of course. Well,
yep.
The school's closed. In 1911, sat vacant until 1916 when Dr. J.C. King reopened the facility as a home for the mentally disabled. The newly formed sanatorium was considered advanced at a time with the treatment of the mentally ill, when the treatment of mentally ill was largely often barbaric and inhumane. However, this superior care included experimental procedures and questionable treatments like insulin coma therapy, electroconvulsive therapy, and hydroshock therapy. And also, even with these superior hospital standards, that certainly didn't stop many of its patients from dying at the hands of their doctors, professionals who have become notorious for performing experimental treatments on the unstable. By 1945, the hospital had treated 6,509 patients, but unfortunately, the staff only numbered 48. In spite of this, the facility thrived for many years, growing to become a fully recognized hospital by the 1960s. By the 1990s, the services at St. Albans were transferred to another location and the hospital was closed for good. Even though the hospital has been closed for many, many years, there's still evidence of the bizarre medical practices on every floor. The hydrotherapy rooms are still intact with their giant tiled bathtubs, and here and there, rusted gurneys and broken wheelchairs lay strewn about. Many of the offices still have patients' folders, images, personal effects, and some of the rooms still display hand-drawn artwork on the walls, evidence of the people who once unwillingly resided there. The roof garden, where patients might have gone to soak up some sunshine in the afternoon, is covered over with a thick mesh to stop anyone from jumping to their death. One room located at the far back of the women's ward, nicknamed the suicide room, has witnessed at least four people take their own lives in the small attached bathroom. Today, St. Albans operates as a historic site, offering tours that recount the building's long history and significance as one of the area's oldest structures.
I definitely do want to go to St. Albans at some point in time. We need to find a weekend somebody's going that we can actually attend.
We'll figure it out.
We'll get there. We'll have to manipulate the schedule. But we do have the general stories that we're going to tell you about. And we're going to tell you both the experiences on investigations that Steve and his team had and that Whitney had with her night there as well.
Yeah. So some of the classic stories, if you will, they range, you know, happened at St. Albans, given its history of being an abandoned hospital, and has the title of the most haunted location on the East Coast. Today, guests are invited to take tours as well as year-round paranormal investigations. There are so many spirits who are rumored to haunt St. Albans that tour staff have lost count over the years. One of the most famous ghosts is that of a little girl who is said to haunt the underground bowling alley. Many believe she may have been the daughter of one of the patients who died while living at the hospital. Other reports claim that a strange mist appears in the bowling alley with the mention of Regina Renee Hall, a young woman who was brutally murdered near the hospital in 1980. Other unexplainable activity includes the sound of disembodied voices, strange shadows darting through the empty halls, and strange signs that investigators believe point to the spirits of women still trapped in the suicide room. The Racker Room is a well-known hotspot, as there is a room with a chair that is often seen rocking by itself. So, yeah, all kinds of stuff going on there.
Okay, so we're going to start with Whitney and then jump to Steve because we're going to share a link from Steve. Now, Whitney was there with a group investigation that involved Chris and Mike from the Tennessee Rape Chasers. She had quite a bit of fun there that had quite a bit of experience as well. So we're going to start in the electroshock therapy room. Her group entered that room, and it was used for electroshock, and she stood at the threshold of the doorway leading into the procedure room. Her head started to burn. She got a hard for her to talk. Her tongue got thick in her mouth, or what felt like it was being thick in her mouth. She entered the room in the back, or as they entered the room in the back that was used for recovery, she still sensed that there was a lot of busy energy in there, taking patients there, wheeling them into the recovery. She felt like she wanted to go to sleep. And they did do an experiment with the REM pod. They asked them to light up each of the colors on the REM pod, and it happened. It felt like the group of them saw an object, and out of curiosity, they surrounded it. Now, Whitney is very sensitive, like me, to different energies and different spirits in the area. We mentioned the bowling alley. That was actually their first stop of the night. Chris and Mike were there setting up their equipment. She sat down in a folding chair at the edge of the alley. The rest of the group was down at the other end. All of a sudden, she felt like somebody was touching her ears. She likens it to like Mork and Mindy, the way he would do it at the end of every single episode. It was very light, but she definitely felt it. Later on, she got the feeling of somebody touching the side of her neck. And that same moment, the periscope that was set up on the frame behind her, it was about 4 feet behind her. It actually was too high for anybody to reach, but it reacted. That actually weirded Mike out, and he didn't expect it to happen. She also told us she was on our tour last night, and she told us that she had started talking to whatever was in the room with them, saying, "I bet you both gutter than I do. I can't do anything but gutters." And Mike started calling her Gutter Girl, and the K2 started going off, like telling them, "I don't want you to call her Gutter Girl." So the ghost was kind of backing her up and telling them not to tease her.
Name calling's not nice.
Yeah, name calling's not nice. So I'm sure the little girl that's in there probably got name called at some point in time and didn't want that happening to Whitney. The isolation ward, also known as the pink floor, they were passing through this room, which was the last door on the right before you head down the stairs. She felt a surge of anger that hit her like a weight out of nowhere. It was like somebody just got right up in her face. She knew she wanted to check into that room to see if there what she could find in there. She was in there with another investigator and one docent from St. Albans. They were all standing near the walls of the room. Without leaning against them, she felt something poke her in the back.
Mm-hmm.
She was wearing thermal underwear, a thick sweater, and a really thick coat with a backpack on. And so the fact that she actually felt somebody poke with all those layers is remarkable. The REM pod was set out as well, and it went absolutely berserk. They were nowhere near it. They had to turn it off and leave the room. When they turned it back on and re-entered the room, it never behaved like that again. So whatever was in there actually had left. So she had quite an active experience there. And since she and I are very similar with our abilities, I'm curious to see that when we go, if I have anything similar to happen.
Now, as we mentioned, we also have our friend Steve Dills, and I am going to drop a link into the chat on Facebook chat here. It has a link to a YouTube video
that Steve put together.
That Steve put together. You might have to copy and paste it.
Oh, there it goes.
Oh, yep, perfect. All right, yep, just took a second. But, yeah, you can go check that out. The video is a few minutes long, and it kind of encompasses some of the evidence that they got during their investigation. But
Steve is a great friend. He's somebody we work with up at Hanover Tavern in Scotchtown.
Yeah.
And him like his heart.
Yeah. So. But yeah. So from Steve, we have his occurrences, the way what he typed up here. So the first experiences that they had occurred during the initial tour of the building, although they were very much like not really aware, they weren't exactly looking for ghosts at this point. They were
Just in the general history.
Yeah. Yep. So they entered the building, and the tour guide took them to the grand staircase. While she stood on the staircase and explained the layout of the building, they were listening and, you know, listening respectively, quietly. And after reviewing the audio of the, during this explanation, they clearly heard a female singing a song plain as day. They weren't able to hear it with their ears during the talk, but they heard it, the EVP, afterwards. Immediately after, they headed up the stairs and directly to Jacob's room. Jacob was the name of a young boy who was orphaned on the steps of St. Albans when it was a sanatorium. While the tour guide spoke of Jacob, and in particular his demise in the sanatorium itself, they recorded the sound of what seemed to be a young boy saying, "I am Jacob." Moments later, after heading down the hallway from Jacob's room, they heard the exact same voice exclaim, "Oh, my poor little Jacob."
That's just creepy.
That's very creepy. Yeah, it's in the video. Very creepy. We do not believe, they do not believe that they interacted with Jacob at that time, but instead they were actually recorded the voice of the man who killed Jacob at the sanatorium. They think that they were kind of being toyed with. Nasty little, nasty spirit there. So then they continued down to the bowling alley in the basement where they were informed of the whistling stairwell. Investigators in the stairwell, which led to the bowling alley, often reported the sound of someone, well, whistling. Instinctively, they decided to whistle as they walked down the stairs, and after they encountered, you know, entered the bowling alley and the door closed behind them, they all clearly, with their own ears, heard the sound of somebody whistling, and it was not any of them. Whispers and EVPs were commonplace throughout the entire evening, from the suicide bathroom on the third floor to random stairwells, and they were constantly being told to shh or hearing bodiless voices attempting to talk to them. Their craziest encounter occurred in the drug tank. The drug tank at St. Albans consists of one rectangular main room with three smaller rooms all along one wall. There were two ways to enter this section of the sanatorium, and one way from the left side of the room or through a long hallway near the three smaller rooms and down a very narrow staircase. They decided that they wanted to use music as a trigger in attempts to make communication with any spirits that resided in this portion of the sanatorium. During the time that St. Albans opened, Johnny Cash was a very popular singer, so they decided to go ahead and start with him. They played one of Johnny's songs all the way through from start to finish and then sat there in deafening silence. All of a sudden, a figure crawled out of one of the rooms on the right-hand side. And it was somewhere after midnight at this point in time. Excuse me. Absolutely pitch black. And this creature crawled out on all fours and appeared to be moving like a cat, but it was the figure of a person. Three of them saw the figure crawl out of the room, and as soon as they noticed it, it darted down the long hallway. Two of them, one of them being Steve, took off running after the figure, but in seconds, it was gone. It made no sound as it moved, and they were unable to locate it after checking around the building.
So, Steve, you're braver than I am. I would not run after it.
Yes, yeah, they had all kinds of interesting stuff going on there.
Yeah.
So that is the infamous St. Albans.
So, yeah, definitely check out Haunted Nights. If they have tickets, still get them. Or maybe we'll talk to Steve about setting up a trip.
Yeah, we definitely like to get it back up there.
Yeah.
Or to get back up there. Get up
get
there, period.
Up there.
We haven't been
boom.
Up there, period.
So this is closer to home. We're going down to Petersburg.
Yeah, so we got our Central Virginia local story to wrap things up for this evening. Petersburg General Hospital.
It doesn't stand anymore.
No. So real quick, though, before I dive into that, make sure I didn't miss any questions. No, I don't. I think so, and
we will definitely check back after.
Yeah, we will check back and chat, follow up with the chat on some of you after we're done here for this evening. But yeah, thank you for all being so active in the chat. We like the interaction. Thank you.
So, thank you for talking to each other.
Yes. Steve says the Johnny Cash song was Ring of Fire.
Perfect. But, somebody named it. I think Tracy called it. I think she said Ring of Fire. So.
Nice.
Tracy, were you on that one? Anyway.
So, Petersburg General Hospital.
Yeah.
So it was originally opened as the Petersburg Home for the Sick in 1884. The facility that would eventually become the Petersburg General Hospital went through many additions, renovations, and general improvements over the course of its more than 100 years. Although no longer on the original site, this is the facility that laid the groundwork for the modern Southside Regional Medical Center. So the institution, if you will, is still around in spirit, excuse the pun. But
in physicality, it's just not the same location.
Yes. Now, when the hospital was first founded in 1884, it was built on land that had been owned by William Cameron. Cameron was one of Petersburg's most prominent citizens in the 1800s, being a tobacco baron and owning a large cigarette factory in the city. It was during the siege of Petersburg during the Civil War that he embarked on a notable, if somewhat head-scratching, endeavor. Over the course of 1864 and 1865, he took to building himself a home in Petersburg. Some might even call it a castle, and many actually did call it Cameron's Folly. Despite the turmoil all around him, it was said to be an opulent home built from some of the finest materials available. The castle and the land it was on were eventually willed to the hospital with the stipulation that the castle would remain. Of course, years later, the castle was torn down for an expansion of the hospital, because that's what they did.
They don't listen to Rome.
That's what they did. In the late 1970s, the hospital was conducting a renovation, particularly of an area where the castle had once stood. Despite the construction, there was still hospital work to be done in the area, and hospital staff were around day and night. It was one of the night shift workers that our story comes from. The woman wished to remain anonymous, but shared her tales of the happenings in the hospital wing. As night shift worker, she would regularly hear sounds that she could not identify, random footsteps, muffled voices, and the like, but she always attributed them to other employees that were just out of sight or working in the adjacent hall or behind closed doors. One early, hot August morning, though, things were different. All the outside doors were open to help vent the heat, and the woman was working in one of the labs. A movement caught her attention out of the corner of her eye, and she looked up expecting to see a colleague, but instead, there was a man staring at her. The man was wearing clothing from the 1800s, but that was the least of his unusual features. The man was engulfed in a flowing mist and could only be clearly seen from the waist up. He had what she described as the most piercing eyes, and she could see right through him to the bulletin board beyond. She was startled to encounter what she knew to be a ghost, and she closed her eyes and asked him to leave. When she opened her eyes again, the ghost was gone, but it wasn't that last eerie experience that she would have with him. From that point forward, she would sometimes hear off-key whistling, feel inexplicable cold spots, and once even felt a distinctive caress down the back of her neck. After having seen the way the spirit stared at her, she knew the follow-up experiences could be attributed to him. She was curious about who the man was, and she decided to do a little investigative work. Her research led her to Cameron's Folly and how it once stood where she now worked. She followed this lead to the Siege Museum in Petersburg, and it was there that she saw a portrait of William Cameron hanging on the wall, the same man whom she had seen on that early, hot August morning in the hospital.
We didn't mention Cameron was once a governor of Virginia.
Oh, I was getting to that.
Okay.
Yeah. So now, yeah, Cameron was a widely respected through the course of his life as a businessman, soldier, lawyer, journalist, and a politician. In the years after the Civil War, Mr. Cameron would eventually become Mayor Cameron of Petersburg between 1876 and 1882, and then Governor Cameron of Virginia between 1882 and 1886. As a politician, he was a member of the Readjuster Party, a coalition of blacks and whites that sought to break the power and wealth of established privilege. Cameron passed away in 1927, and it seems that in spite of all his accomplishments and admiration, he might not have been able to rest easy with his castle having been torn down.
Yeah, the governors are known to haunt places that were very important to him. In this case, it's where his house was. But also, some of them are known to haunt our capital today. Governor Extra Billy is known to actually haunt the halls and show himself, and people recognize him by looking at his portrait, which is in, I think, the Senate wing right now.
Sounds right.
But I haven't been in there in a while, so it could have moved.
Yeah.
Last time I saw it, it was in the Senate wing.
Yeah, so that is the story of Governor Cameron and how he haunts the site down there.
Yeah. Now, we did have some questions. Whitney, thank you for jumping on, reposting the video in response. That was awesome.
Ah, yes.
But Patrick said something about an interesting question from Kiana, and I missed that.
I had a good question earlier. Oh, so much chat. This is wonderful. But can I find it?
Wait, is the back down?
Oh.
Is it that?
There is a conversation that's been happening around about how horror movies and ghost tours reinforcing negative stereotypes around people with mental illness. How do you manage telling an interesting story with showing respect for the patients who have historically inhabited these facilities? Very good question.
Very, very good question.
I think the biggest thing is always you share the stories, but you always reinforce the fact that looking back, that the treatment was inappropriate and despicable.
Yeah.
And it was you don't want to
glorify it.
No.
You have to understand that they didn't have the knowledge we have today. And unfortunately, getting that knowledge involved a lot of mistreatment and ill use of patients. You don't want to say you have to accept that, but you have to acknowledge that.
Yes. And Whitney says, tell the stories and tell the truth. And that's
tell the history.
Thing.
You got to have the context.
You do have to have the context. And, you know, it's worth noting, and we wind up with this oftentimes, there's the issue of mental illness comes up on our Shadows of Chaco tour.
Quite a bit, because there are hospitals down there.
Yeah, but one stop in particular is we pause by the Craig House in Chaco Bottom.
Yeah.
Now, it does not have a very clear, definitive ghost story, although it is believed to be haunted. But we stop there. It's kind of a good layover point. It's during one of the longest walks that we have between stops. But it's a very historic building, a beautiful building, kind of stands out from the rest there in the neighborhood. And it has a very clear tie to a story of mental illness.
Yeah, Mr. Craig's daughter, who was actually the mother of one of Poe's best friends when he was growing up and possibly Poe's first crush, she unfortunately was considered mentally ill, and at that point in time, we're talking late 1700s, early 1800s, institutions were not as around as they were later in the 1800s, and a lot of times family members were kept at home, locked away in a room, and that was what happened.
For better or for worse, it was the compassionate alternative, mm-hmm. because the facilities that were around back then, they were horrible.
Better to keep the person away at home, hidden away, than...
Well, the hidden away part is controversial. Most often they were hidden away because of society and because people were ashamed to have somebody suffering from mental illness.
Yeah, I mean, look at George III at the time. He was completely declining into mental illness during our Revolutionary War and post-Revolutionary War.
Yeah, but the key thing is you tell the story, you tell the truth, you put it, you say that in hindsight, obviously, I mean, we know that these treatments were not good for the people. And
they didn't help.
It did not help. Sadly, there are cases where it was blatantly disrespectful and unhelpful. They were being used as guinea pigs.
Yes.
But
we've talked about that in prior stories with some of the haunt types by old hospitals.
Yeah, but then there are the instances of where people genuinely believed that this was the best that they could do. And as terrible as it seems in hindsight, it was just kind of the fact of the era.
Yeah,
so
as we progress as a people, as we progress in our scientific knowledge, things get better, but it's often from a worst-case scenario that they get better.
Yes. So.
And you just can't forget that we have advances because we've had the worst-case scenario.
Yeah. But, yeah, I'd say, you know, that's how we approach it. And to their credit, I think that even modern horror films, one and in TV shows, American Horror Story is a perfect example, you know, it's blood and guts, and it's absolutely horrific. And, I mean, that's the idea. It's a horror movie or a horror TV show, but they also make sure that it's scripted in such a way as to not glamorize the terrible treatment.
Yeah. You never want to glamorize it.
No.
You always want to be stark naked truth.
Yeah. Or even if you are going to fictionalize it, you need to make sure that the fiction that you write is
accurate.
It's historically accurate, but again, does not glamorize the terrible treatment that these people were subjected to.
Yeah. Well, even like we were just watching Black Sails, and there's a storyline in there of one of the Lord's sons was committed to a mental institution because he was gay, and there's a second storyline from him that they say that, and you assume through most of the show that he committed suicide in this institution, but when in fact his father had him secretly whisked away to a Virginia plantation, or it wasn't Virginia. It was a Florida plantation.
Well, maybe Georgia.
Anyway, somewhere southwest.
Yeah.
That was designed to keep unwanted family members hidden away. And they worked the plantation. They had a normal life, just working and having to stay at this plantation.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. So, that's excellent question.
Yeah, very good question.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Okay.
I think that was it for the questions.
Okay. Cool.
Yeah. So we will go ahead. We'll banter with some of you in the chat after we get off of here. But thank you very much for tuning in this evening.
Yes, and there will be a second hospital because there are a ton of hospitals out there that I want to talk about. And I've already started a second script. So
yep.
We will come back to hospitals later on and talk about more of them.
Yep. But in the meantime, just a quick reminder, we are going to be off next week. We're going to be going to an every other week format. Mm-hmm. And
we're going to do Haunted Ships.
Haunted Ships. So we have done Haunted Ships before. Actually, it was our very first one. We did Haunted Ships and Haunted Ships.
And Lighthouses.
And Lighthouses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this time I'm focusing just on ships.
Yeah.
So we're going to focus on that. We're going to do a second one of those a little bit later on that focuses even more intimate area. But look forward to some Haunted Goats next week.
Yeah.
Or not next week, the week after next. Sorry. Got so used to saying that.
2 weeks, yeah. Yeah, you know, so we're breaking the streak, but we need to do it for...
Yeah, I've got four scripts that I'm working on right now.
Yeah, you do, but you also got several tours that we're actually going to be giving this week.
Yeah, so I'm busy.
Now that we're back at work.
I am very busy.
Yes.
So, yay!
Yeah. So, again, thank you all very much for tuning in. We appreciate it. And we hope that you'll come back and join us here in 2 weeks.
And we hope we will see you on a tour soon.
Yep.
Or at an investigation that we're at. So hopefully we'll be at a couple coming up with Steve and the Transcend crew.
Yep. Yep. So we'll be talking to him in the near future. I know that. And, beer
chatty. That whiskey is talking to the beer.
Yes, it is. Unfortunately. Wow. Okay. But, yes. So, thank you very much. And if there's anything between now and 2 weeks, feel free to drop us a note anytime.
Yep. And with that, we will say goodnight for the evening. Enjoy the rest of our thunderstorm. Hope you guys are staying safe. And we'll see you around.
Yep.
Bye.
Cheers, everybody. Good night.